Abbey's Jewels. I'm told it's extremely cold in London.
We don't care.
Because we're in Doha. But it's actually a nice breeze. And
it's lovely.
It's pleasantly cool. But what is heating up, Jewels, is the World Cup, because we have our first finalist, and it's Argentina. And tomorrow night, we'll find out who our second finalist is.
Yeah.
Will it be reigning world champions, France? Or will it be the big upstart to this World Cup, Morocco? I think most people here in Doha, I got to tell you, are rooting for Morocco.
Leave me alone.
Anyway,
I don't care.
We're gonna try to do our best to try to preview that, but we got to start with Argentina beating Croatia. And Jules, I'm going to come out and say this. I've been critical of Argentina in the sense that I felt that they hadn't put in a 90-minute performance.
Yeah.
Maybe against Poland in the group stage, but certainly not against Australia, where they allowed Australia to get back into the game at 2-1 and had a scare at the end. Certainly not against Holland, where they generally dominated the game, but then eventually got back to 2-2, went to penalties. This was a commanding performance, and I think credit has to go to Scaloni. Some players obviously shown, Alvarez, Leandro Paredes, I thought as well, Rodrigo de Paul had a good game as too. And there was no Messi dependency. Messi was like the cherry on top with what he did for the third goal. In terms of growth, this is a team that's getting stronger as the tournament progresses.
Yeah, which is what we kind of expected after the defeat against Saudi Arabia. We said you can't forget what happened before that and the run that they've went on under Scaloni leading into this World Cup. And yeah, that was a freak result. It really was. And nothing really went their way that day. But you knew that it was not going to go back to scratch. However, they had to find the right formula. They had to change a few things. I think Scaloni, certainly of the last four teams, the last four head coaches, is the one that has changed the most compared to the others. You can pretty tell me the starting 11 of the other three. With him, and as we saw again today, with the four central midfielders that started, he keeps trying tactically to outsmart you, to change something, as long as it's just Alvarez and Messi up front, because that doesn't change.
It was interesting because obviously we talked about this before, the way Croatia beat Brazil. Zlatko Dalic says, I have the best midfield in the world. We can debate whether it's true or not, but I think it's pretty darn close in Mateo Kovacic, the Braz, and of course Luka Modric. And against Brazil, what did they do? They kept the ball, they outpossessed them, they made Brazil chase them, and they picked their spots, and then eventually they prevailed. Now, Argentina, it was clear to me that this is what they were going to do because they're playing to their strengths. So how did Scaloni counter that? He went with four midfielders. He ditched the back three that we saw against the Dutch. He put Paredes in there.
Yeah.
You have another guy who can pass the ball. I'm not a big Paredes fan, although I thought he was very, very good this evening. We were both at the game. We just came back, by the way. If we look a little disheveled, you know why. And that really, really disrupted. Now, in the end, by the end of the game, you'll see that Croatia had 60% possession, whatever. But it doesn't matter because in terms of big chances, Croatia created very, very little.
Only two set pieces, yeah. And I think to go back on Modric, because I think these stats, in a way, sums it up well. Started okay, started well, but then had his lowest passing accuracy of the whole World Cup. Only five passes in Argentina's final third compared to 22 against Brazil, for example, where, okay, he played extra time, so that was an extra half an hour, and he came off today after 81 minutes. But still, only five passes, which meant that when Luka Modric had the ball and the passes that he managed to do, hardly none of those passes were actually in an area that could impact the game and that could hurt Argentina, which shows you how well they kept him quiet. I mean, they kept quiet Brozovic. Kovacic was a bit different because he's got more dynamism. That's what he does. He runs with the ball and he progresses with the ball so, so well. And yeah, you're right. That's where they won the game. They got a bit lucky, Argentina, let's be honest, on the two goals.
I was going to say that. The first two goals, I was going to say that I rode back from the Lucille Stadium up the road with somebody who was telling me how lucky they were, how they were a bit lucky. That person, of course, was you, Jules.
Yeah. But you have to be honest. It's true.
So the first goal is a case of, I don't know if Lovren gets confused, turns the wrong way. He's entirely out of position.
But before that, Modric almost intercepts the ball.
Yeah. So you can make that point, and it goes through. And then Livakovic brings down Alvarez. Nothing Livakovic can do. And Messi converts on the spot. But again, I think that's kind of the sort of luck that you make a little bit, like on the second goal, where, I mean, Alvarez goes through like a runaway train, right? He picks up the ball inside his own half. It's a loose ball coming off a transition. He goes into the box. The ball actually caroms twice off of Guardiola and once off of Borna Sosa. Yeah. And then he just kind of pokes it in. The ball could have gone anywhere before that. But it's made by the fact that he's pushing, he's sniffing, he's there. So when the door of luck opens, he's there to take it. And then at 2-0 in the second half.
The game is over.
But I think even if they hadn't scored, it felt to me, I mean, Argentina came really close, I think, with a header. I think it was Tagliafico just before halftime as well. Could have been 3-0. It seemed to me like early in the second half, Croatia were entirely out of steam. And we saw that because 5 minutes into the second half, he abandons the possession game. He takes off the bras. And at that point, it's wingers. It's Petkovic. It's Croatia going direct. Scaloni counters by going back three. And at that point, you know, effectively Croatia become one-dimensional. And they lose.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the game was dead at halftime anyway, regardless of what anything Dalic could have done. I mean, they didn't believe in it either. They were just not on the day. They were just not good enough overall. And they didn't have a striker in this tournament. They went that far without a real striker, like a proper good striker.
Kramaric, thanks you.
He's not very good.
Petkovic, thanks you.
He's not very good either.
Budimir, thanks you.
Even less. So this is where we are. So if you go down, unless you've got something like against Brazil where you're not gifted the goal, but it's very much helped by the opposition, it was always going to be very difficult to come back today. And Argentina, as you mentioned to me in the car on the way here, this time stay composed until the end. Maybe because they were less tired, because before that they didn't give as much energy out as they did against the Dutch, for example, or even against Australia. I don't know. But they certainly look more composed and much more in control for the last 20 minutes than they ever did.
Well, and in the last 20 minutes, we also saw, while you say the game was over at halftime, we saw what I thought was one of the more remarkable things that I've seen in a football pitch, and I've been watching World Cups and football for a very, very long time, and that is the goal that Messi sets up for Alvarez. Messi receives the ball on the right inside his, kind of just inside the Croatia half. He has Josko Guardiola on him, who is not just one of the outstanding centre-backs in this tournament, one of the outstanding centre-backs in Europe. He's a guy who's 15 years younger than Messi. Yeah. And you figure, if Messi's going to beat, at least what I figured, Messi's going to do a bit of skill. He's going to nutmeg him or something. He's going to make him fall over, and he's going to scurry away from him. That's how he can beat him. Or Messi's going to draw him and other defenders to him, and he's going to pull off a ridiculous pass, like for the goal against the Dutch, right? Where he draws people in and whatever. Instead, Messi runs. The ball sticks to his foot. It seems like he takes a million steps, right? And he ends up beating Guardiola through athleticism. Skill, obviously, as well, because the ball sticks to him. But he ultimately runs around him.
True, but the dummy...
How do you do that?
The dummy is outstanding. For me, the dummy is outstanding. I mean, he turns him over twice, which is really remarkable.
But then he goes around him. He turns him over, but he's in the box.
So he gives away a penalty, Guardiola. I think Guardiola is limited once Messi has turned him over the second time, because otherwise it's a foul. But I thought that Guardiola would have like literally cut him in two way at the start of the move. And instead, once Messi's in the rhythm like that, you can't stop him.
I thought that was amazing.
I thought
that was really special. One of the best pieces of skill that I've seen in this World Cup.
Yeah, completely.
Now, in terms of numbers, obviously Messi setting up Alvarez for that goal. Alvarez with the two goals.
Alvarez got 7 goals now in 8 starts for Argentina. He's proven so good. And you know what I love tonight, which we noticed already against the Dutch as well, is that, well, I mean, he presses a lot and runs a lot. This is what he does. But also, everything that he does, all the runs that he makes that either stretch the defense, he can come short as well, and he did it a few times tonight. But he's looking for that runs, those runs over the top, and the runs that will stretch that defense, which, for example, Brazil never really did against Croatia. No. But with this time, when you don't just play in front of Lovren and Guardiola, it's far harder for them, like we saw in the first goal, where Lovren is just like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And Alvarez brings you that. It's not perfect, and he's still very young, but what a future he has.
The amount of running that Alvarez does, and look, I don't know if he's ever going to be a prolific goal scorer. On the way over, we bumped into Hernan Crespo's in later
next
studio
door.
Next door. Yeah. And then just outside here was Sergio Aguero, right? So those two guys, two legit goal scorers, sort of forwards. I don't know if Alvarez will grow into be that type of player in terms of goal production. But in terms of running and effort, because you talked about him pressing for Argentina.
Yeah.
Pressing is something that needs to be collective. When the other guy up with you is Lionel Messi, it's not going to be collective pressing. It means you have to, because otherwise you just run around, you know, like a maniac on your own.
Yeah, really, on your own, yeah.
And there's an intelligence, there's an incredible work rate to the way this guy moves because he's not getting the help from Messi. Understandably, nobody's having a knock from Messi. Calm down, Messi fans. I thought that was exceptional. In terms of Messi, some numbers. Messi scored his 11th World Cup goal. He's well behind the record. He's not going to beat it this World Cup unless he scores, I think, 5 goals in the final, which it's messy, but
it's still possible. But
he became Argentina's all-time leading goal scorer at a World Cup, passing the legendary Lion King, Batigol, Gabriel Batistuta. And he equaled the record for appearances in a World Cup with 25 held by Lothar Matthäus. Yeah. A record that we presume he's going to break. He's going to break on Sunday in the final.
Yeah, you would think so. And so I think now he's on 25. He will get to 26 if everything goes well for the final, which is likely to be his last ever World Cup game. I mean, come on, unless he plays at 39 in the US, which is very possible. But we don't have that vibe and that feeling right now. So he could win his first World Cup and the first one for Argentina since 1986. As well as breaking a record that I'm not sure will ever be beaten, or it might be beaten by someone like Kylian if he keeps playing.
Of course, it's Kylian who's going to beat the record.
But if he plays 7 games every time he plays the World Cup, and he's 23 now.
If France gets to the final every single World Cup, it's only going to take him 4 World Cups to get to 28.
Exactly.
And beat Messi's record.
Exactly. So, yeah, let's see. But still,
or, you know what?
What a special day.
He doesn't need to get to the final. It can be a whole bunch of third place games. It's always so exciting. When you love
always
that.
Always so exciting. But yeah, so. Well, what a special day Sunday could be for Messi, of course.
A word on Croatia, because I think they gave everything we have. We've talked about the spirit, the small nation, big boys.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, great generation, too.
Dalic pushes all the buttons. I'm curious to see, you talk about generation, I'm curious to see what it's going to be going forward. You might get another couple of years out of the Bras. Dalic has said, I'm on Modric to stay.
Okay, Modric is 37.
Let's see what Modric says.
And to be fair, because I'm writing on Modric for the website, and I looked closely at him at the end. It looked like he can always change his mind, but it looked like this was the last game. And he might play on Saturday in that third place playoff game. But it looked the way he said goodbye to everybody, the way his body language, and obviously he was gutted to have lost a World Cup semifinal. Of course he was. But still, it felt very much, there was a wave at the end towards the Croatian fans who were behind the goal on our right, where we were sat. It felt a bit like that. But again, it might be tempted to stay, although 18 months is a long time for someone who's 37 before the Euros.
I just think, I've been so impressed with what Dalic has done in this World Cup against Brazil, before that.
Yeah. Against Japan.
I mean, between this World Cup and obviously the previous one where they got to the final and lost to France, I thought that was absolutely exceptional.
Incredible.
And a lot of those stereotypes that we talk about in sport about, you know, never giving up, fighting till the end, digging deep, pride, all those words which are hot air, which every little league coach has used. I mean, he uses them to great effect. Hats off to you, Zlatko Dalic.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, enough first semifinal. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, Gab.
All right, Jules. It's semifinal time for your boys tomorrow, France versus Morocco. Let's start with injuries. Reports that Adrien Rabiot and Dayo Upamecano are unwell.
Yeah, that's right. Upamecano has a sore throat, second day in a row where he doesn't train, which is a bit worrying. For Rabiot, it seems that it's the beginning of the illness, and they might both be okay. I was told tonight that they're still quite positive about them being fit enough and ready enough to play against Morocco on Wednesday. If they're not, Konaté is going to come in.
One of these guys is easier to replace than the other. So center back, you have a billion options.
Konaté will come in. Yeah. Who's already started two games.
Kind of like a smaller version of Upamecano, smaller, weaker version of Upamecano.
No, he's taller. Is he taller?
Yeah,
taller, yeah.
Upamecano, though, is like more.
Yeah, but, you know, Konaté is definitely taller.
You'd wait in a street fight, Upamecano, though, right?
No, he's too sweet. No.
Too nice? One,
yeah, too nice. Yeah.
All right, who can bench press more, Upamecano or Konaté?
Yeah, maybe Upamecano, although I think it's a close call. It's a really close call.
All right, okay.
I'm more worried about Rabiot because
he doesn't have a replacement.
Fofana will come in, I think, and Tchouaméni will play higher up, and Fofana is the holding midfielder, which I've been a bit disappointed by what I saw from Fofana against Tunisia, against Poland too, and that could be a problem even if France will have 70% of the ball. So I don't think it would be maybe as important. I mean, Rabiot would be a big miss more than Upamecano because you would rely as well on his runs into the box against a very low block and a very compact block. You need that kind of player.
He's not going to make those runs.
No, definitely not. And doesn't attack the ball. He's not as good in the air either. So, yeah, Rabiot would be a huge blow. Huge blow.
And for Morocco, in the meantime, we assume Mazraoui's not going to be back.
No, I get it.
Walid Khedira, we know, isn't going to be there.
Your friend.
My buddy.
Uno
Linoy, because he's suspended, obviously.
Yeah. Saïs should be okay, I think, but I don't know, 50%, 60% of his ability because I think the leg is going to be still tight. So we will have to see. But
Saïs played the last game injured.
He came off anyway. So, yeah. So let's see. But Regragui said, we're hungry and we're not tired. So you have to believe him. Gab, it's not just the Moroccan national team that is doing well at this World Cup.
Yeah, so I have to say, I hadn't put two and two together. I read about this, but it's Moroccan football that's booming. So Morocco won the African Nations Championship, which is this competition that they have, which is only for players who are based in Africa. So, you know, none of these guys who play in Europe would have been there. And that's a good bellwether, I think, of what you're producing domestically, because they tend to be younger players. You know, I'm sure there's a couple of these guys who maybe were born in France, but the vast majority of them are people who were born in Morocco.
Yeah. So 14 out of the 26 in the squad were born outside of Morocco. So
No, but I'm talking about at the African Nations.
Oh, yeah, they're all.
So yeah, they're all people who play in Africa.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming they're not going to be the other way around.
Yeah.
So that's impressive. Obviously, Wydad won the Champions League.
Yeah, with Regragui as the manager.
Which is what got him the job. And then they've also won the last three CAF Confederations Cup, which is kind of like the Europa League of African football. So
that's right.
There's a lot of depth right now to what's happening in Morocco. And I think it's very exciting because, look, you mentioned 14 of the 26 born abroad, blah, blah, blah. I think Algeria a few years ago, maybe two or three World Cups ago, they had a team where every single person was born outside of Algeria, everybody except for one. Here, they've obviously taken a lot from the Moroccan diaspora.
Yeah.
But also there is a lot going on in Moroccan football behind the scenes as well.
Yeah, they created the Academy Mohamed VI from the name of the king, of course. 10 years ago, I think it was now. It's a guy called Nasser Larguet, who then became the Marseille head of Academy, for example, who is someone very well known in France and in North Africa in terms of scouting the young players, the recruitment, that work. And, I mean, to be fair, the Federation spent a lot of money on that. They've got basically a brand new kind of training ground like St. George's Park in England or Clairefontaine in France, where they just bring those talents like Unai and Nisiri, who are the two biggest names, if you want, to come out of that academy. And now you get rewarded for all the time and the money that you spend in that academy with those talents. The other thing quickly that they did, Gabby, is that before they used to wait until players were maybe not called up by the other country if you want. So maybe you get to 25, you Sofiane Boufal, France still haven't called you up. So Morocco comes to you and says, hey, why don't you come and play with us then? Right. Now they go much younger. So they've got this process and this structure in place where you're 14, 15, they know that one of your parents or your grandparents are from Morocco, even if you don't live there. And they say, why don't you come and see our structure? You can train with us. If you want, you can play. You don't need to take a decision now because you've got until playing for the first team that really right. really matters. And I think that has worked really well with Hakimi, for example, that they went and get when he was 16, instead of waiting to see if maybe Spain was calling him up. And I think that also is part of the reason why they've been so successful on getting those players from the diaspora playing for them and not for their other countries.
And it makes them feel involved because, as we know, like in this group, you know, there's players who, for example, they don't speak Arabic or they speak very poor Arabic because they grew up. You know, it wasn't part of their household at home. You know, they may be of Moroccan descent, but, you know, they didn't speak it in their home. So it still makes them, they obviously feel a strong cultural connection.
Yeah.
This really, I think, has made a big difference.
No, it's big.
All right, Jules, now we're going to both pretend that we're bald. I'm closer to it than you are, I think. But let's channel our inner Stuart Robsons and play out the semifinal tactically. You touched upon this before. You expect low block, 70-odd% possession for France.
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple. It's not a criticism at all about what Morocco are going to do. This is what they've been doing so far against Spain and Portugal. They've got no reason to change because it's working really well. They are the best defense in this World Cup for a reason. Although he came under the previous manager, Vahid Halilhodžić, who defensively was very good and sort of like drilled them very well. And that is what they're going to do, and then play on the counter with Ziyech and Boufal and Nizeri as well. Use the set pieces. For France, the key will be, for me, what they have in Spain and Portugal and Croatia and Belgium to a certain extent don't have or didn't have is those two wingers very good on 1v1. So the key for France is to move the ball quickly, to go wide as quickly as possible, to move that low block that shuffles well, and then Dembele and Mbappe will go 1v1 against Hakimi and Mazraoui if he plays or someone else. And that's where I think you can hurt them, because when Nico Williams, just to finish, came on for Spain, for example, in the last 16 game, that's really the only time where Morocco were on the back foot a little bit. They were not sure, and Nico was taking on Mazraoui with success, dribbling past him, putting crosses in the box. France will have Giroud in the box, and if Mbappe and Dembele can make those differences on the wings, then I think we create danger.
I would agree with you on paper. The one thing that I'm wondering a little bit, this is still Didier Deschamps, and he won the last World Cup, obviously, with a lower block and hitting on the break. Is he going to be tempted to go and attack and have the ball from the first minute? Or might we see something where he says, you know what, I don't trust these guys, Ziyech, set piece, whatever. I know that they want to sit and hit us on the counter. I'm going to sit too.
But there's nobody between the...
Obviously, it's not going to turn into a cartoon show, right? But, you know, instead of sending tail with the wingers and so on, just being more conservative himself, trying to draw them out that
maybe.
Way.
Maybe. I don't think so. But maybe that's an option. I mean, the French don't like being favorite for that reason, is that they prefer hitting on the counter. But there's games where you can't do that when you are the better team, and that would be the case tomorrow. So I'd be surprised if even Morocco allow France to be able to hit them on the counter. That would be very crazy.
Well, because we saw them play with a higher line against in the quarterfinal against Portugal relative to what they did against Spain as well.
Yeah, so true, but because they didn't have players like Mbappe and Dembele to attack the space anyway. So it makes sense. You can't play a high line against France or you're going to get really, really exposed, I think.
Not a high line, but I'm just throwing that out as a possibility because Morocco have a coach who I think he's done it a certain way, but I think he can also be a bit unpredictable he's got ballers, he's got people who can play.
True, I think the highest possession percentage is like maybe 40% in this
World Cup. I'm not just to say high possession, but there is a way to think to be more direct.
Maybe possibly
catch him by surprise a little bit. Is it more risky?
Maybe.
Yes, but you know what? How many times are you going to play in a semifinal? And if you get that goal,
true.
And then you go and you turn it into the Alamo.
I'm more worried about the fact that France can't break the deadlock because Morocco defend very, very well again, and then we get frustrated, and then that's exactly what they want and what they feed off. And then I'm not sure what the French would do if they get frustrated and so, like, lose their focus. I think that would be dangerous.
Key men for Morocco, in my opinion, again, Caster and Pollux, a.k.a. Sofiane Amrabat and Unahi.
She said names that no one would know who they are.
I think we have a lot of very educated people in Greek mythology among our audience.
Gab, the referee for France v. Morocco is the Mexican Cesar Ramos. Care to speculate about who might get the final then, considering who is staying, who is still here, and who's gone home?
You're mistaking me for Dale Johnson here.
I think you love your referee, like, trivia.
So, it's interesting because obviously...
See? Already.
There were 12 referees left, right? So, if you assume it's going to be somebody... I thought Ramos was going to get to the final because he was close to perfect. He got very high ratings thus far. And obviously the nice thing about having a Mexican referee in the final, you have somebody who's totally confederation neutral and whatever else.
And you can't get semis and final. No, that's not possible.
No, you can't get semis and final. So looking at who's left, bearing in mind that the other choice assignment, if you want, is the third place playoff. Yeah. I think there's probably three potentials in terms of people who have not refereed since the group stage. One is the guy who I would have had as a favorite before the tournament. Again, depending which countries get knocked out and whatnot. And that's Danny McAlee from Holland. Another one, potentially Anthony Taylor from England, we haven't seen again.
Last time an Englishman refereed the World Cup final, we remember what happened.
I don't know who.
2010, Howard Webb.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Crew kick that he's the only one in the whole
Nigel of
the
Young.
Yeah, not to have seen it.
Oh, but what about when Graham Paul refereed and gave out the three yellow cards?
Stop it.
I think Anthony Taylor's a good referee. It's interesting. McAlee was involved in a game where he was messed up. Where he made a mistake in the group game. I'm forgetting what group game it was.
Yeah, it looks
like it was actually the VAR, Paul van der Boekel, who messed him up.
Okay.
If I had to guess, it's going to be one of those three. McAlee, Klaus, who's from Brazil, or Taylor. I think the one issue with McAlee is, remember there was so much, McAlee's Dutch. There was so much aggro with Argentina and whatever, and the Dutch.
True.
Is this something that the referees committee would take into account? Colina, before the tournament, told us no, we're entirely independent, blah, blah, blah. You don't necessarily, sometimes in the past they've avoided these situations. It would be a shame if they do think he's the best referee for the final. It would be a real shame if he keeps it. Luis Enrique didn't do an exit interview when he left his job as Spain manager. Instead, he did things Lucho style by going on Ibaianos' Twitch channel.
Yes.
For those who don't know who Ibaianos is, he's got a bazillion followers. He's
big influencer in Spain.
He's not just, I think, throughout the Spanish.
Spanish.
I mean, he's enormous, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if he's bigger than Cabi. He's not bigger than Cabi, right?
No.
Okay,
is.
So that's
it's a different
thing.
Style. It's a different style. He does more like interviews and stuff like that.
But Cabi's more important, right? Globally.
Cabi's funnier.
Cabi's funnier.
For sure.
Cabi's more handsome. So, yeah. And Cabi's Italian, which
of
makes
course.
Him better.
Yeah, I knew that was
but funny. Anyway, 2 hours they spent talking.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. One of the things that we learned was that he wished given Sarabia more playing time.
What's the point of a random thing to say. I know, and why did you tell us that now? Well, you should have done it then. What prevented you from doing it?
But it's even, he said, there was one man in the 26 who let him down. And I kind of feel like, you know, it's like Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he says, you know, like, or no, that's later, I think, when Peter denies it. But Jesus says, one of you will betray me.
Yeah,
and it's not Peter. A spoiler alert, in case you haven't read the Bible, it's Judas. Is this what he's referring to? Like, why would you say this? And then you're kind of leading people to speculate who
was. That's the Greg Berhalter, Joe Reyna story, exactly the same way. He said, like, one of them I didn't like.
Greg Berhalter wasn't meant for public consumption. This is the big difference.
I mean, but he still said
this guy goes on Twitch. He knows he's talking in front of 2 million people.
Yeah, but Berhalter, we all knew that.
We're going to get to that.
So it's similar. I don't know why he felt the need when Ibai said to him, what would you change? I think that was the question.
Yeah.
And he said, well, that one player, so now everybody's obviously trying to find out who the guy is. So
I don't think it's Pedri.
I don't think it's Gavi either. But you have to just basically, we're not going to give you, but look who didn't play or who didn't play much at all.
Or who played and played badly.
I mean, he didn't play again? Because if he was disappointed, he would not have played him more than once.
I honestly don't know. But why would you set up, as much as I love him, why would you set the situation up? Also, why can't you do a press conference like a normal person? Like, what are you? Who do you think you are? Bielsa? You're not Bielsa.
Yeah, he loves that Twitch, doesn't he? He loves Twitch.
Right, go and spend hours on Twitch on your own. Go get your.
Now he's got plenty of time.
He's got a lot of time on his hands now. Exactly.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million dollar stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify is your no excuses business partner. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Because businesses that grow grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/gabjules, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/gabjules now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/gabjules.
I have a secret. Uh-huh. I use Secret Whole Body Deodorant because more than just my armpits stink.
Oh, can I use it where my bra rubs under my...
Oh, yeah.
And what about down there? You know, my...
Totally. 4 out of 5 gynecologists would recommend it. So I tried it, and now I get 72 hours of freshness from my pits to my...
Ooh, I love that it's a spray.
Me too. And it comes in sticks and creams too. Go get your Secret Whole Body Deodorant.
Plenty of national team coach talk, Gabi, because Ronaldo, the original, the Brazilian, says that he would love to see a foreign coach taking over Brazil.
Yeah, but there's a little caveat here.
Yeah. He wouldn't be happy if it was you or me as foreign coaches. He wants a big name.
He said, like, he'd love to see... The names that he mentions are Pep Guardiola.
Yeah, okay.
Carlo Ancelotti.
Okay.
And Jose Mourinho.
Okay, so none of them were free right now. Thank you, Ronnie.
But even if they were, it's like, yeah, gee, who wouldn't want Pep Guardiola or Ancelotti? Okay, Mourinho tends to divide opinion a little bit
more
now.
More debatable.
But still, but like, yeah, of course.
Lovely. I mean, you know, why not? If you can try Ronaldo to tempt one of those three, but yeah, good luck in the process. I mean,
so it's not just the original Ronaldo. It's also the Football Association in England who are reportedly open to a foreign coach too. But most of the media, and of course I think the FA as well, are hoping Southgate's sticking around.
Yeah.
This has reopened the ancient can of worms debate.
Of course.
Is should you have a foreign coach?
Yeah.
Where is it acceptable? England have obviously had
a few before.
They've had Fabio Capello, they've had Sven-Göran Eriksson.
Yeah.
They've had two. Does it matter? Do you care? Would you care? If Pep Guardiola, after Deschamps retires, if Pep came to manage France, would you feel like he's letting down the legacy of stellar French
managers? All I would say is the language for me is the key here. If it's someone that is foreigner but who knows the language, who knows the country in a way, I don't know. I mean, I've never been in this position anyway, so I've never even thought about it until I had a chat with our friend Rory Smith, who is completely against it. He said, like, you should not even be allowed as a country. You can't recruit a foreign striker. Why would you be able to recruit a foreign manager? I was like, okay,
it's kind
maybe.
Of stupid because it's a completely different role. And
but it's completely against England having a former coach, like a foreign coach, sorry. Which I'm like, okay, well, you know, but why if all your ones who are English are rubbish? What do? You take a rubbish one? He said, but look, imagine, for example, if Tuchel was appointed, have a German coach in charge for the English national team, would that sit right with people? I said, I've got no problem with it, but... I mean,
yeah,
clearly in England, they have a few issues with it.
Yeah, I'd have no problem with it if it were England. Would I have a problem with it if it were Italy? A little bit, because it would mean that a generation of Italian coaches has failed.
Yeah, so you redo that process, but in the meantime, you're not going to wait 10 years with some dude who's rubbish.
Exactly. And also, I'd love to see if Pep Guardiola comes out tomorrow and says, sorry, Man City, I've won enough. I want to go and manage England.
Yeah, or Jurgen Klopp. Surely they will.
Did you think they'd say, oh, no.
No,
Gareth Southgate's gone. All right, let's get Potter.
You were not born in Yorkshire, so you can't be
our coach. I don't buy that. But I'll give you, it's funny. Years ago, Sunil Gulati, when he was in charge of the United States Soccer Federation, this is well before they appointed Klinsmann, he always used to say, no, we have to have an American coach because no foreign coach has ever won the World Cup.
Yeah, which is still the case now, by the way.
Still the case. Yeah. I thought, oh, great, that's your objective. But the retort is easy. No American coach has ever won the World Cup.
True.
No living English coach has ever won the World Cup.
True as well.
So, you know, I think you got to put it in context.
It's a good point.
It's not for everyone.
Yeah, no, definitely. Meanwhile, Portugal have reportedly approached Roma about bringing Jose Mourinho home. We know that Fernando Santos is leaving, potentially, or will leave. And according to Arbola, I think it was this morning, the report was that Mourinho was the number one target, despite still being very much under contract with a year in extension as well possible. With Roma, that I think Abel Ferrara and Reed George maybe or someone else was the other choices. What do you think?
He's under contract with Roma, so it would cost you. You'd have to pay to get him out of his contract.
Yeah.
Mourinho has hinted at wanting to go and coach Portugal at some point. Would he do it now after having spent all this money at Roma, after won the conference and showing in some forward project, planning in his project and all this jazz? I don't know. I don't know that it would necessarily be the appeal. I'm also not sure that Mourinho would be a logical fit for Portugal with the players they are now, given the type of football Mourinho has played.
Yeah, maybe.
That would be my main question mark. Obviously, if Mourinho...
And it's not like they don't have enough great coaches, you know, that can come and take over. Like, if there's one country that's got millions of great coaches, it's them. So,
I mean, I think right now, sort of, if we're talking about outstanding coaches per capita, Portugal are probably number one by a mile.
By a mile, indeed.
More from the original Ronaldo, just because we love him so much.
Yeah, of course.
He says Mbappe is a lot like him.
Oh.
He was sweet because he corrected himself. Well, not like me now, but like me when I was his age.
Because now it's not the same.
It's hard to think of a bigger compliment you can give somebody,
I don't
right?
think so. Even if Ronaldo was not really Kylian's generation, you know, Kylian grew up with Cristiano as his idol. No, Ronaldo was a little bit too early.
The different Ronaldo he had his idol.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean,
he
stylistically,
was born when Ronaldo was in the 98 World Cup final. So.
Ronaldo probably physically stronger than Kylian Mbappe.
Yeah, as well. And
in terms of flat out pace, I think they're pretty darn close.
Yeah, the pace, the skills as well.
Technical ability.
Slightly more for Ronnie, maybe.
I'd say slightly more for Ronaldo.
Yeah. But still, great. If you're Kylian, I think you would feel really like...
I think
like,
you'll take that.
Yeah, big time. Rafael Leao has opened contract talks with Milan, Gab, to renew his deal. How is that going? Process.
It's a slow process. And I said, there's a lot of elements here. And, you know, he's got 18 months left. One of the big elements, one of the big elephants in the room is still... We've talked about this before, is the fact that when he left Sporting, if you remember, it was they canceled the contract. He left on a free transfer, and it was because the ultras came in and smashed up the training ground and attracted the players.
Went to Lille for free. Yeah.
And then there was a trial, and they said no, you have to pay compensation, and he's personally liable for the compensation.
Yeah.
So they have to work out something with Lille, I think, because Lille are the ones who got him for free and they made a profit when they sold him
million.
To Milan.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one. Obviously, there's a lot of clubs who are looking at the situation and who want Rafael Leao because by the way, we're going to get to this in a second. If you think about it right now, Armando Broja injured at Chelsea. We're going to talk about him in a minute. Gabriel Jesus injured at Arsenal. And Cristiano Ronaldo gone from Manchester United. Those are three clubs who could all probably use a center forward. And Rafael Leao is pretty darn good. Sticking with Milan... Zlatan Ibrahimovic revealed that he is Olivier Giroud's idol. Are you buying this, Jules? You know Giroud better than I do.
No, of course not. I mean, they're the same age, pretty much. One is 36, one is 41. So it's just like... but I love the line, of course. And he was very...
You know, I'm picturing a 14, 15-year-old Olivier Giroud being kind of nerdy because you was very educated and went to university and stuff like that. And in the meantime, Zlatan is 20 and he's the bad boy of Dutch football. And he's probably getting those like weird magazines that they had back then in France about foreign football.
Yeah, like Onze Mondial.
Cutting out pictures. Exactly. Onze Mondial, there Onze you Mondial. Go. Cutting out pictures.
No.
He probably had Zlatan posters.
A great idea, but no.
No?
No. Okay. No, not this time. But sure. We love Ibra. We've interviewed him last season. How great he was as well, and that's another punchline, which is lovely. But he'd been before, he did an interview for French television and was very, very, he was praising Giroud a lot and saying that he should go to the World Cup. And now I think it shows that Zlatan was right.
It's nice to see because theoretically they're competing for a starting spot.
But getting on really well as well, so that's good. Merlin Partners, who own Lille, have made a binding offer for Sampdoria in Serie A. Gab, how badly do they need a new owner?
So the guys who own Lille, it's two guys. One is an Italian guy and the other is some other dude who's not Italian. The Italian guy's name is Alessandro. I actually met him in London a while back. I'm blanking on his last name. They're making an offer where, I mean, Sampdoria are nearly functionally bankrupt.
Yeah.
Their owner was literally, Ferrero was literally in prison. Then he was under house arrest.
The bottom of the table as well.
Yeah. They need, I think what they're trying to do is do something where they're going to take over. They're going to take on the liability of the club, and they've pledged to invest money in the club, probably from next season. I think Sampdoria have to go down to come back up. It's obviously a historic club. This is the club of Roberto Mancini, of Gianluca Vialli, of Pellegrini, of Mikhailichenko, of Toninho Cerezo, of Gianluca Pagliuca, of Moreno Mannini.
Oh.
The list goes on, the legends that have been through there.
And what a shirt as well.
And one of the coolest shirts in history, which I believe you've worn on the show.
Yeah, of course.
On the show before. We want them back in Serie A. We want them back run normally. We want serious people owning clubs, not Ferrero.
And they're doing a good job with Lille. So I would really trust Merlin Partners to do a good job at Sampdoria too.
Hugo Lloris texted Harry Kane to console him after his penalty miss for England against France. Jules, I imagine that's appreciated.
Yeah, very much so, Gabby. I think it's the right thing to do from Hugo. He waited a little bit before texting Harry. And they've obviously been very, very good friends for many, many years now. So you can understand, even I think for Hugo, it was difficult to see his mate as happy as he was, but to see him miss and to see him so sad, everything. So they had a lovely, lovely exchange. And they will be friends again, of course, when they go back to London together.
I have a question here, which I think some of our audience might have. I think I know the answer to it.
Yeah.
So if it's one dude texting another dude, right, one of these two people must have revealed that they got the text. I'm assuming it was Harry Kane who said, oh, I got a nice text from Hugo. It's not like Hugo like, look at me, I'm so nice.
No,
I sent a nice text to Harry Kane.
Because we asked him this morning at his press conference if he had spoken to Harry. So he said...
Oh, okay. All right.
So in that context...
He didn't volunteer the information.
No, not. Okay. It's not like when you give $1 million to charity and then you said, hey, by the way, I gave £1 million to $1 million to charity. Gab, what happened to the 32-team World Cup, Club World Cup, sorry, and FIFA's big plan to have it in the U.S. in 2025?
So obviously this was part of Gianni Infantino's plan. They were originally, I think, they were going to have one in Brazil, then they went away from it, and then this is something that UEFA don't like because they think it might detract from the Champions League.
Yeah.
Equally...
It's a lot of clubs for a Club World Cup.
Well... FIFA's point for the U.S. is a very big country. It's less teams that are in the real World Cup. The idea from FIFA's perspective is we got rid of the Confederations Cup. Let's go and do this instead. The ECA, the European Club Association, met here. And obviously, not saying clubs in the rest of the world aren't important, but without the ECA, you don't have all the money and the interest because the ECA is what brings you Real Madrid and Manchester United and whatnot. Infantino didn't raise the subject because he didn't want it to get knocked down. I think it'll probably happen. It has to be done in such a way that UEFA are okay with it.
Yeah.
That they really don't see it. I think if it's something every 4 years.
The question I have is why do you go straight from. So why is it now? Six? Is it six? Something like that?
Yeah.
You've got. 6 to 32. Why don't you try, I don't know, let's say 12 to start with, and then maybe you can go to 16.
So it's a nicer number.
Yeah. No, but you know what I mean? Like, why jump straight from 6 or whatever it is to 32 and change, so, which would change the whole dynamic of the season for a lot of those clubs?
No, because it wouldn't be during the season. It would be in the summer. It would be the summer.
It would mean that
basically, like, ultimately would mean that instead of clubs going on tour in the U.S. and in Asia, the ones who qualify would play here and they would be paid a lot of money for it. And obviously, if you have, because you can't have 16 European teams, right?
Yeah.
If you have 32 teams, you could maybe have 12, 13, 14 big European teams, which means you then make a whole load more money, and then you can distribute, and FIFA have more money to give away. And the way FIFA officials get elected is they do things that generate money. But by the way, FIFA lose money on everything that they generate except for the World Cup, right?
Yeah.
So that was the thinking behind it. I just think you have to think it through, and there has to be a detente. There has to be some kind of peace between, obviously, South America and Europe on one side and FIFA on the other.
Yeah, sounds complicated to me, but that's it.
Speaking of Club World Cups, I think it's far likelier, Jules, that we're going to get a women's version before that.
Wow, okay.
Are you also, it's all too complicated.
No, I mean, yeah, but they would not be 32 teams, right?
No, there might not be 32. Maybe they're 16.
Yeah, exactly.
I think this is something that would be fantastic.
It would be great.
Because it's not something that would be dominated by the European clubs. In fact, my women's soccer, my WOSO sources tell me that most NWSL teams could more than hold their
100%
own against the top European 100%. Sides.
I think to grow the game, this could be very, very important.
And I'm told it could happen even, obviously, the Women's World Cup next year, 2023. As early as 2024, they could be doing this. You'd have to figure out where in the summer, whatever.
And how you qualify. And,
I think this would be really, really cool. You get, I don't know, maybe you get like the top four from NWSL, maybe the four semifinalists from the Champions League. You get a couple teams from Australia, a couple teams from South America, a couple teams from Asia. I know there's going to be differences
I'm with you completely.
But this is the way forward. I want to know what the best women's club team in the world is. Don't you?
Yeah, for sure. I'm a big advocate of this. Guy, we could be getting the initial Super League verdict in the next 48 hours. You've been waiting for this.
Not for the initial verdict, because the initial verdict is non-binding. Yeah. It's just the verdict of the Chief Justice. We're expecting it on Thursday.
Right.
Now, just to let you know, a lot of people are going to get very excited by this. But what I've been told from both sides, so both the UEFA side, who kind of want to maintain the status quo, say football's not just a business. It has a certain sporting value and so on. So FIFA should continue. Sorry, UEFA. And by extension, FIFA should continue running it. And by the other side, by the Super League clubs who say, no, we should run this ourselves. It's not fair that UEFA are both regulator and tournament organizer, whatever. The Chief Justice thing is not binding, and there's no guarantee that the court, it's not really a bellwether of which way the court goes. And because I've heard this, I've also seen reported, oh, no, it's an indication. I don't think it is an indication. I think the Chief Justice, their report will likely come closer to the UEFA side. Okay. But I think we'll get an idea, because if he's 100% on the UEFA side, I don't think the final verdict will be too far away from the UEFA side. If he's a little closer to the middle, if he says, well, maybe UEFA, UEFA should give more of a voice to clubs or whatever. Maybe they shouldn't do this part, they shouldn't do that, they shouldn't take money from here. Then I think we could get more of a final verdict on the other side. So it's a bellwether in that sense, but it's certainly no guarantee of how the final verdict is going to come.
Yeah.
And the final verdict, by the way, is expected in March. And depending how it goes, it could be cataclysmic. It could be change the face of European football, as we've told you many times. João Félix has been strongly linked to Aston Villa, Jules, mostly by his agent, Uncle
Indeed.
George. But according to reports, he's not too keen. Should he be?
Well, I think he wants to play in the Champions League to start with, and there's no guarantee right now that Aston Villa can say to him, listen, the next year, or in 2 years, or in 3 years, or in 4 years, we'll be there. So already you take a bit of a risk. Maybe you saw what happened to Coutinho, who went there, started okay, and now has disappeared from the team, certainly before Unai Emery took over. And maybe for we know he doesn't want to play in England. Maybe he doesn't feel like that suits his style, and maybe he's got a point. And unless he plays for City, for example, maybe he's not too keen. I don't know. But you can't... you can't tell me that Aston Villa is the most appealing club right now that could go after Joao Felix, right?
It's weird that this Villa line came out. I mean, I don't know if Emery said, oh, yes, I like Joao Felix. I like the talent.
If you're a coach, you would want, you might want to take
it. He's a talented player, right?
Yeah, he's a very good player. But
wouldn't you expect other teams to, bigger teams to come forward to say, I want to work with you, want to be patient? I mean, he's not that damaged goods at this stage, is he?
No. Well, I disagree with that.
6 months loan at Wolves?
Oh, my God, imagine that. That's the next phone call from Uncle George. Armand Broja's injury is worse than expected initially, Gab, and it's an ACL, which means we won't see him until next season. What a terrible injury in a friendly against Aston Villa, by the way.
Yeah, I'm a big Broja fan. I thought Chelsea should have stuck with Broja, Havertz, Sterling, whatever up front. Not signed Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, your boy.
We know that.
Sorry.
We know that.
Obviously, now he's injured. I don't know that Chelsea can go between now and the end of the season and finish top four with Aubameyang, you know, the silky German, best on earth, Kai Havertz, Sterling as your front man. Is there somebody I'm forgetting? You want to play Pulisic through the middle?
Mount if you want at the middle. I don't know. He's capable of a lot of things, Graham Potter.
I mean, I think they got to go out and get somebody.
Yeah, I think
it's not a good position to be in.
Igbali and Boli have kind of mentioned it already, and I think they're looking. But you're right. Where do you go? One, we know that January is a tough transfer window, really tough. Two, do you go for a loan, which you like the idea? Would you go for...
The loan idea for Arsenal. It's another discussion we had in the car. We should start taping the podcast in the car, actually. Not for Chelsea.
Not for Chelsea.
Not for where they are.
Good luck to go and get someone of the caliber that they will want in this January. I don't think there's many candidates.
What about the guy who scored a ton of goals for many, many years? In fact, I believe he scored more international goals than any man alive. Christine Sinclair has many more than he does, of course. And who's a free agent. And
surely
not. Todd Boehly was into, no?
Very much into in the summer. Maybe Cristiano is the answer there.
No. I don't think so. I don't think he's going there. FIFA have released a statement in support of Iranian defender Amir Nasser Azadani, who plays for Traktor, and he's reportedly in danger of being executed for his role in the anti-government protests, Jules, and also protests for women's rights, trade union rights, and so on in Iran. It's a sad situation. It's good to see FIFPro making a stand.
Yeah, and it's right for them to do it. I think this is something that has to be taken very, very seriously now, because you just cannot let... I know that we often say that football and politics cannot mix. Well, often they do mix, and in this case, they have to mix, because I think the football world and the football family as a whole could come and defend him, help him, protect him, maybe whatever they want to do, whatever they can do. I think this is the moment to do it for everybody. Whether you involve, you get Messi involved, you get Cristiano, you get whoever you want, we cannot let that happen.
You know, it's funny because when we talk about football and politics mixing, and obviously it's been a big issue in this World Cup.
Yeah, especially, yeah.
One of the arguments around it is that there are certain values which are universal human values, right? So against racial discrimination, right? We say these are universal human values, and so it's not political to say, you know, do not racially discriminate. I think we can get enough of humanity together to say that unless you've committed treason or murder, you cannot be executed. You can go to prison. So, you know,
should go to prison for protesting for women's rights.
Well, but that's a different one. But that's fine. But that's taking a stronger view, right? But I'm saying is, like, you know, some countries have capital punishment. Whatever your view is on it, personally, I'm against it, but whatever. Like, we should have a line that you cannot be executed for speaking your mind, which is what this guy was doing.
Yeah.
Right. That I think we can move the bar a little more. You know, 40 years ago, when we had apartheid, or maybe more than that, 60 years ago, we maybe couldn't go and demand, you know, not to have discrimination. I mean, maybe FIFA wasn't in a position to do that.
Yeah.
Today they are, right? I think at the same time, we can also move it. For speaking your mind, you cannot be executed. I don't think it's a big ask. I think it's a baby step. And I think it's the least that this guy deserves. And then
completely.
You want to put him on trial. You know, we're not interfering with your legal system again. I have my views on it. You have yours. I imagine they're pretty much aligned on this point.
So.
But to say you can't put somebody to death like this, whether he's a footballer or not, I think that should be a minimum
step. Definitely. And finally, Gab, Pelé's condition is stable, but he's still in hospital. We know what to do, right?
That's right. Ore, get better soon. We miss you. We want you. We want your old age to be happy and filled with joy and serenity. Condition again, stable. That's encouraging. But you know, we're all with them. I think the whole world. You saw the outpouring.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
There's your question. The number of lives that Pelé touched. Jules, this brings us to an end. But we're going to come back on Thursday in just 48 hours.
Incredible.
After that massive France-Morocco game, we're going to have either a very happy Jules or a very sad Jules. We will debrief that game. We will look ahead. We're going to preview the final. It's all coming your way in just 48 hours. Until then, love the game. Love your neighbor. Love yourself.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.